Hey folks, thanks for tuning in to the BAMF podcast, our special, unprecedented D&D news edition.
That's right.
Before we dive into it though.
It's awesome every time.
I love how Tundra was doing the jazz hands in the corner. That audiovisual intro assures you that you are listening to only the highest quality podcasts.
That's right.
Handcrafted with love here at the BAMF podcast birthing creche. And with us today is a panoply of RPG luminaries here to talk about the new news from D&D. And before we get ahead of ourselves, Owen Casey Stevens, your man to know. Can you tell us what this new D&D news actually is?
Yeah, so there are two bits of D&D news. One is small and one is potentially huge, and we don't know how huge. Yeah. The small one is that they're doing a D&D rules expansion set in 2022 that will include Xanthar's Guide to Everything and Tasha's Cauldron of Everything and a new book called Monsters of the Universe. And that'll be in a nice slipcase. And that's nice, right? New book, new product, great. But executive producer Ray Rininger also announced that at the D&D Celebration live stream that the next evolution of Dungeons & Dragons will be arriving in 2024. And then refused to say exactly what next evolution of Dungeons & Dragons means. He did say that it would be compatible with 5th edition, but people don't know if that means, is it going to be 6th edition, but compatible in that you can use a lot of the stuff? Or is it going to be a 5.5 like they did 3.5, which they said was compatible, but in some kind of important ways wasn't? Or is this going to be something that is a different presentation, like new rule books or new ways of getting the material, but it'll be the same material just with errata added, and everyone has their opinion, and no one knows for certain. And that's why it makes for a great show.
Yeah, I remember a webmaster friend of mine talking about how the days after 3.5 released was a bumper crop year for gaming forums.
Yeah.
Because there was so much to argue about.
Yeah.
So, all right, so that's the lead. What do you guys think about this? Owen, why don't you go first since you're already talking?
So my personal opinion is that what's going to happen is we're going to get a new core rule book, a new player's handbook, which may or may not be called a player's handbook, and quite possibly a new Dungeon Master's Guide and a new Monster Manual, and that they will be mechanically exactly the same game as 5e, with errata and improvements built in, but they will present things differently and have different options from the get-go. So, for example, a lot of people note that in Tasha's, one of the options is to say, look, when you pick your species, that does not impact what stat modifiers you can have, that anyone can put their stat modifiers anywhere they want, so that we're getting away from biological essentialism. My guess is that that will be the standard in the new player's handbook, whatever that'll be called, released in 2024. And so if you get that book and you make a character, you'll be like, oh, well, I can put +2 in strength and +2 in dex and -2 in wisdom. Even though I am a gnome, I can be a really burly, fast, dumb gnome. And that if someone wanted to take the old rules, they will work exactly with all the new material. They will just tell you a slightly different way to make it. They might have new classes, or they might have the same classes but with new subclasses. So it might be that we still have a warlock, but they're a different pack, so they're still fighters, different subclasses of fighter. They might do a whole new set of classes and not mention the old ones at all, but as long as all the old ones work perfectly, that's still the same game, just a new presentation. When they did 3.5 and then 4.0 for both of those, I sort of tried the idea of the Player's Handbook 2, because Monster Manual 2 and Monster Manual 3 and Monster Manual 4 had always sold well. So they were trying the idea of, hey, there's a Player's Handbook 2, there's a Dungeon Master's Guide 2. And those just did not have the same buy-in for people as a Monster Manual 2. And I personally think that's because when you were using Monster Manual 2, you really didn't need the first Monster Manual. You could literally have Monster Manuals 2 and 4 and just use the monsters from those. You didn't need 1 and 3. But with the Player's Handbook, they didn't repeat all the rules, because then people would complain, hey, I'm buying a book that is mostly rules I've seen before. I think what they're going to do is make a Player's Handbook 2, not call it that. They may call it, you know, Player's Handbook Evolved, or they may just call it the Player's Handbook and let the old ones go out of stock. And you'll be able to pick up whichever player's handbook you want and use it with all the existing materials. That's all a guess, but that's a guess based on a tiny bit of insider knowledge, much of which is between 10 and 20 years old, and paying attention to what the current sort of markets of things going on are.
That is interesting stuff. Jason, what do you think about all this, sir?
Well,
I agree with Owen on a lot. I am expecting something different in some ways too. I think we're going to get Dungeons and Dragons. It's not going to have an edition number on it. It's not going to say 5.5. It's not going to say 6. We have to remember that D&D 5th edition has sold more copies of the Player's Handbook than every other edition of D&D combined. And data surveys have shown us that Wizards' audience is skewed young, right? And so to most gamers and to most of the people that Wizards wants to catch as new D&D players, 5th edition is the only version of D&D they've ever known. So we're just going to call it Dungeons and Dragons, and we're going to get rid of all the edition wars. We're going to let the old people that give a shit about that care, but we're going to ignore it for most people. And it's going to be, I think, much like what Owen said, but I think it will have all the standard classes in it, but it will update all that with stuff from Tasha's. For example, every single class got a power-up in Tasha's. This is something a lot of people know, but it's weird as a game designer to see an expansion book, Tasha's Cauldron of Everything, just straight up change every class in the game. It gave every single class a new ability, not as an optional, but like everybody gets this. And if you have Tasha's, then you know about it. And if you don't have Tasha's, you don't. As a game developer, that's weird because it feels like, well, if I'm a new player, like, am I being somehow cheated because I don't have this other book? Like, and so they'll consolidate all of that. It'll still be all the classes that we know from barbarian to wizard. But it'll have updates and revisions. And I think in that sense, it'll be kind of conservative. What I'm more interested about is the other big branches of D&D, which is DM's Guild and virtual tabletoping. DM's Guild is free money for Wizards, and it's done well for them. You can tell because they've expanded it. They've added additional settings, which they would not be doing if they had buyer's remorse on DM's Guild. So I think a lot of people are worried that DM's Guild won't continue, but I would be reassured if I were those folks. Like, why would Wizards stop? I see Owen not agreeing with me, I think. The other question, however, is virtual tabletop. I think Wizards definitely sees virtual gaming as the future of the hobby. Maybe because of our quarantine situation, but maybe because of streaming or everything, frankly. And they're, you know, we were talking about this in the office lately, that Wizards doesn't really compete with regular RPG companies like us anymore. They don't compete with Paizo or Green Ronin.
They never did.
They compete with Blizzard and Marvel. Like, they're an entertainment company now. They've got movies and television shows coming out, you know? And so they want to, why should they let Roll20 or Foundry or any of these other companies corner the market on virtual tabletops, what they could do it themselves? Now, we all remember, I hope, 4th edition and their attempt to do this before. Owen, were you at the company when they did D&D?
No. Okay. No, I was already gone.
It's infamously a huge failure. Like, they poured money into it. It never happened. But they've learned a lot since then. They've got Magic the Gathering Arena to learn from and other possible venues, and they've got a lot more money, frankly, to hire smart people to do this with. They can pay, well, they pay twice my salary, right? Like, the salaries at Paizo and Wizards are basically double. So they have the money from Hasbro. I think we probably all remember.
Well, Hasbro has the money from them.
Yeah, that's exactly
right. Wizards of the Coast turns a bigger profit than other divisions of Hasbro.
That's
even
right.
If it has less total budget.
That's right. Hasbro is now a role-playing card game company with some other stuff attached to it.
That happens to make toys now and then.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're gonna have their own proprietary virtual tabletop. And the question is, how much will it be integrated with the game? And I'm reminded of the 3rd edition rulebook, which always had a lot of like, and 3.5 was even more like this. Oh, and you'll remember. It was more integrated with the miniatures and the battle maps, and it really emphasized using those 3D props to tell the game. I wonder if the new Dungeons & Dragons will assume that you are playing the game virtually and will point you towards D&D's Wizards of the Coast's proprietary virtual tabletop as a way to play your D&D. Anyway. That's my thoughts on it. I'm interested in it. I haven't played D&D in years now, but I like it. It's a good game.
It's doing okay. Yeah. Walt. What are your thoughts on this, sir?
Well, first I want to ask a question. What are you playing when you get that fantasy itch?
Well, see, now that I'm a senior developer at Paizo, I have to pitch Pathfinder 2 Adventure Paths, right? And I firmly believe that you have to play the games you write for. Like, I make them better. I understand them much better when I have run them at the table. So I'm getting ready to run Strength of Thousands, the Hogwarts in Africa Pathfinder Adventure Path that Ron Lundeen and a slate of fantastic writers of color have come in and written for Paizo. So I'm getting ready to start that right now. Come on, man.
There are some great game designers who don't play the games they write. And I don't know how they do it. I can't. Right? I'm with Jason. I have to play the games, and as a result, right? I'm currently playing 5, 6, 7 different sets of RPG rules from 3 different companies on any given month. But I think there's still a good deal of overlap. I know there are other people at Paizo that are playing D&D, that play Blades in the Dark, that play. So it's a good idea, in my opinion, to as much as possible, no matter how much of a company man you are, right? I play Fantasy Age. Yeah. It's a good idea to play other things. And even if they're not your favorite, even if they're not what you're writing for, frequently you can see, oh, I see why they made this different design decision. It does this different thing better and this other thing worse. And that was the choice they made. I think it's going to be true of the Wizards of the Coast people working on the next evolution of D&D as well.
Yeah, I love reading other companies' adventures. I've been reading a bunch of RuneQuest adventures lately, and the latest generation of RuneQuest stuff is just so brilliant. I love it, and I love the way it evokes the setting in a way that's just really good.
One day, someone's going to buy the movie rights for those medieval ducks, and then we'll just all be over. But I'm glad to hear you guys say you play. About 10 years ago, I got into a frank email discussion with a guy who was kind of a big deal in superhero RPGs at the time, and he's currently not really working in RPGs, so I'm not going to say his name. But the guy said, "I don't effing understand you people who want to play games pretend you're superheroes." At the time, this guy was publishing one of the bigger superhero RPGs on the market.
Yep.
And I just wished him good day and was on my business. But anyway, and
especially when you're freelancing, that can happen, right? I'm not saying that I have never written for a game that I would not choose to play, but I try not to make that my business plan.
Yeah. In my opinion, like gaming is so modest in its financial reward. Like, if you're not getting love out of it, you're doing the wrong thing, right? Like, We don't get paid enough to write games we don't like, so I want to write stuff for games that I.
Well, I mean, the side
of that is sometimes we're not getting paid enough to turn down work for games we don't like.
Well, and I wish you were wrong, but you are not.
But doesn't that the power and the fame and the swag balance off at some point?
No, the power.
No, it doesn't. It totally doesn't. I have had people ask me if it's such a terrible grind of an industry. And if you look at people that got into the RPG industry the same time I did 23 years ago, there aren't many people left doing RPGs, right? Most of them have either given up on writing entirely or have found ways to write things that are more successful, or at least partially write things that are more successful. But I consider RPGs to be important. I think they do things that nothing else do, and I think that it is possible for us to make it better, and I'm going to keep banging my head against the wall of making things better until they are better or I concuss myself.
All right, I want to hear what Walt thinks, because I think he's got some salty opinions. So let's...
Walt looks salty.
I feel salty. It was weird to watch, like, the whole that particular day of the D&D celebration thing, because it seemed like a majority of the people who were speaking and talking and presenting, it seemed to me like I had been left out of this conversation. Oh, really? You know, so not because they were forcing me out, but just because they really weren't presenting me with something that myself and a lot of the people that I play with would really enjoy. And one of the complaints I've been seeing recently is that a lot of the stuff that's being produced, especially on DM's Guild, is just rehashes or reskins of things that have already been out there. And, you know, my argument is, hey, look, these designers got to, you know, these designers got to eat too, bro. Yeah. You know, if you're enjoying the stuff, buy your like. If you don't enjoy this stuff, you know, don't pick that up. But don't harsh somebody else's fun, because, you know, that's when we really do it for the groupies. You know it, Jason. You know, don't harsh somebody else's fun, because somebody might really enjoy that product that you didn't enjoy. And you know, having that negative connotation out there about it, it just doesn't really do anything for the positivity that should be inherent in this community versus the negativity that is so often, like you go on like forums and stuff like that. And it's just like, prime the trebuchet with the bullshit. We are ready to launch, you know? And it's like, there's no reason for this, bro. It's a game. Play it the way you want. You know, nobody's saying, you know, but back to the point at hand, it just seemed like a lot of the stuff that, you know, that was being presented. And I equate a lot of this to art because, you know, I came up as an artist. I've been doing RPGs for since 2004. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it was one of those things where art, if you want to sell me on a product, show me the art. Okay. If the art conveys the feeling of what that game's going to be like, 90% of the time I buy it. Even if I never play the game. But and I was looking at the art and I was looking at the, you know, all the stuff, and it just seemed to me like everything seemed so anime looking. Everything seemed so, you know, like genteel. And I, you know, like even going to the DM's Guild, one of the biggest products on there now is something like the relationship guide or something like that, or the guide to marriage, yep. You know, a mithril bestseller. And I'm like, wait a minute, D&D is supposed to be my escape. You know, I don't want to marry somebody in the game. And, you know, but that was somebody's fun. And I'm just like, and watching a lot of this presentation, I was like, yeah. I don't think that this is the game that I'm supposed to be playing anymore. And even though it's the biggest game, it, just like World of Warcraft. World of Warcraft came out and everybody was like, this is the greatest thing ever. I played it for 5 minutes. I'm like, wait a minute. So I got to kill 30 rats before I... No, I'm all set. You know, and that was it. So I think the big inclusions of a lot of stuff that are bringing so many people in are fantastic. And I really hope they tighten it up with what comes next. The weird thing for me was there was some commentary about playing the game nonviolently.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know. It just seems a little weird to me because, like, if you're going after a, you know, like an animal that is extremely violent inherently in its nature and blah blah blah, you know, that particular creature might not give you the opportunity for that. So I'm not hating on the idea. I'm curious to see how they do it because I'm interested in it because one of my big loves is like infiltration and like espionage RPGs. Yeah. I love them. And when I was in the army, one of the principal guys that pretty much taught me everything I knew about being a soldier, he said one of the things that is big in our business, because we were long range, you know, reconnaissance guys. Sure. He's like, if you're forced to pull the trigger during an operation, you failed. Now, if you pulled the trigger because you needed to, that's a different story. But if you are forced to, if the enemy forced your hand to pull the trigger, you know, we should be invisible. We should be at ghosts, you know, and that idea of like the espionage guy who has the MacGyver thing to everything can work his mind around the problem versus working his blade through the problem. I always found that interesting. So I'm really interested to see where they're going to take it. I recently saw a show not too long ago where a bunch of designers game players for this one stream had their wives come on and talk about their experiences with the game because they play as well. And it was a whole different mindset from these guys because where the guys were, you know, mostly playing for adventure and smash the orcs, you know, these female players were talking about having safe spaces and talking about having, they had an island in their campaign that was just for retreating from the world so they could be alone with their thoughts. And I'm like, I could do that at home. Is that because I'm a guy? You know? So it was really weird to see the juxtaposition of the two play styles.
Yeah.
And like I said, I'm kind of interested to see where they take it, because from a gameplay standpoint, I prefer like the old style game. So if I'm going to play anything like Swords and Wizardry or Castles and Crusades, I don't want mechanics that tell me how to role play at the table. You know, I want to be able to do that and innovate on my own. So I'm kind of interested to see, for people who want those mechanics, how they're going to portray them and how they're going to use them to enhance the game at the table. So that was kind of my deal on it.
Well, I have tons of thoughts, but I don't want to Owen, what do you think?
So first I want to answer Walt's questions. No, that's not because you're a guy.
The
bloodthirstiest, most likely to start a fight, heavy side, this is going to go to bloodshed, let's go to bloodshed player in my Mega Hex is my wife.
Right? He will
pull the trigger before, famously. You know, there have been encounters where there are people at the road and they're like, ooh, there's a toll and there's 10 gold. And she's like, no, there's not. And she shoots one, because this is going to be a fight. We'll go to a fight.
Does she ever yell out Lenora Jenkins?
At the same time, there are tons of guys I know who are very interested in creating world building and doing safe places. And I tend to straddle both those worlds. So I don't believe that there is any gender essentialism locked into play style between people. I do think that there are men who are bloodthirsty and want to get to the fighting and kill the orc and rah, rah, rah. And I think it looks like there are maybe more of them than other things, because the industry has catered to us for 50 years. Right. That this grew out of wargaming. It grew out of specifically beating up and killing things. And a lot of that DNA is still in there. As far as nonviolent resolution goes, I thought one of the best things about 4th edition were skill challenges. Yeah. Right. A mechanical way of handling an encounter where you'd say, hey, what's going on here is the tavern's on fire and there is no point in punching the flames. So here are a set of rules. For, hey, I'm going to try and usher people safely out. I'm going to try to organize a bucket brigade. I'm going to try and collapse one room so that the fire will have a fire break, where you've got things other than killing people. And the same thing can be applied to negotiations. And I think what D&D wants to do is have the best set of tools they can have for the most play styles without compromising their base.
Yeah.
So I don't think that they are going to release a player's handbook that has any less room for magic missile, long swords, and barbarian rage, right? Those are absolutely an important part of the game. But if they can do a game where they say, hey, if what you want to play are the courtiers around the king, and the king is a bloodthirsty idiot, and what you are trying to do is actually impact change from the inside, you know, Chris Premis mentioned not too long ago that for him, the biggest fantasy in D&D is that you automatically get 8 hours of sleep at night. Right? There is no insomnia in that game. That's the fantasy. I've got people for whom the fantasy is, I want to make this kingdom better. That's what I can't seem to do in the real world. What I want to do and can't is actually improve the social safety net. So I think adding those rules is going to be very much in the circle of making a game that will play well. If you've got rules for that, then you can take those rules and apply them to an online tabletop, right? So that those mechanics will be there so that the GM can say, okay, this is going to be a social challenge. Here are our three social zones. Let me know if you're going to try and make a diplomacy check to move from outside to inside the inner thrall. We've got game mechanics for it. Here are the DCs. And that will go well on tabletop, instead of just saying, hey, everyone has to wing it and the virtual tabletop has nothing to offer you. But I don't think they are going to assume that people are playing on the tabletop. I really think they are going to try to make sure they got enough rules. And then you can have a book with optional rules and a book with optional rules to handle lots of different. Yeah, okay. don't get me into why fire elementals should not be immune to fire damage, by the way, because I'm not immune to being hit in the face with a 200-pound fish, and it's made of meat. I think they are going to try and be ready for that, and I do think there will be a level of integration. I doubt that they're going to do it entirely on their own, and the reason I doubt that is because the game master, the Dungeon Masters Guild is a huge success.
Yeah.
Because they don't run the Dungeon Masters Guild. They right. let someone whose expertise, one bookshelf, which is drive through, whose expertise is do that, because what Wizards of the Coast is not is a online tabletop company or a video game company. And they're sure they're branching out into these things, and I could be wrong, but I think what they're going to want to do is find someone who already has a fantastic tabletop. And just like the Dungeon Masters Guild doesn't say it's one bookshelf and you can't buy other stuff on it, they're going to take that tabletop and they're going to get that company because they are the 600-pound gorilla. If D&D says, hey, we'll let you brand this as D&D if you give us a cut, no one, you can't easily play anything else on it, and it does these specific things well. That's what I expect to see. And yeah, I think the rule book will probably specifically say, hey, you can go to the Dungeon Masters Guild and buy third-party products. You can go to dungeonstomp.com or whatever they call it and play online. And that level of integration I expect, but I don't think they're going to do anything that risks four people in their mother's basement killing wargs.
Yep.
That is still a big part of their game.
For sure.
But once their market is as big as it is, if they're like, hey, without losing that, we can expand this market by 10%, that 10% is the amount of money that entire other game companies, more money than most entire other game companies make. And that is, I think, where they are probably going to be looking to expand and allow for additional things rather than change what their core is. They're just going to try and make a bigger tent.
Now, Owen, just to tell you, dungeonstomp.com is available for purchase. If you have ideas, man, I got the wallet. Let's do this.
All right. I want to address Walt's comments because I found this very interesting. And I think so. What I see this is, Walt, you were saying, like, it looks very, you were described as anime and genteel, and your focus was on everyone seems to be focusing on relationship role play rather than fighting orcs.
Well, that's the thing, because like for me, the relationships at the table are very important.
Oh, sure.
But I don't want
You're not here for a dating game. You're not here for a dating sim.
Yeah, just because of the fact that most of my job for the both my careers for the past 30 years have been relationship based.
Well, so I see this. For one thing, I want to note that I work with colleagues in my office who are hollering for a fantasy dating RPG. that's what they want to write. And if they can do it in Pathfinder, like, it's a matter of time. Okay. But I think what we're seeing here is the influence of shows like Critical Role.
Yes.
Right? Where the relationships between the player characters and the NPCs are a key factor in what brings people back. It's engaging, and it's brought in a group of people who are watching it not for fighting the orcs, but they're watching it for the relationship drama, right? And they're also watching it for the laughs. A lot of streaming shows are comedy shows, and we want to create opportunities for that kind of wacky role play, and also. More and more streaming shows, like people are doing makeup and cosplay for the show.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
And so the art in the book are going to reflect that. Like the art in the book is going to look like stuff people can cosplay. It's going to intentionally be done so that you can inviting fans to cosplay these characters at conventions, right? It's kind of like what happened with Batgirl. If you remember when DC came out with that Batgirl.
With the sneakers.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was kind of a revolution because it was like the company was finally acknowledging that, hey, we can get fan engagement if we create costumes women are not embarrassed and humiliated to wear.
I was super stoked when they did because one of my good friends that I came up with in the Army, and he was like the classic trope that you used to hear about in the 80s and 90s. He was arrested because he was a gangbanger and they gave him a choice.
Yeah.
Go to the Army, go to jail.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, fast forward many, many years, married, children, had converted to Islam. It was exciting to me to say, hey, I know your kids are into comics. There's this whole there's this whole what do you call it comic right now about I believe she's Pakistani, Ms. Marvel.
Yeah,
right. This and look at the costume. Your kids could cosplay this.
Yeah, that's right.
They were stoked beyond the moon. I mean, it was so cool to see that reaction to that.
Now, one last thing I wanted to address is your observation about like infiltration kind of games, right?
Love those.
And I just got finished writing one. Like P2 Pathfinder 2nd has this whole infiltration subsystem, right? Where you can like you. It's kind of like what Owen. It's kind of inspired by skill checks, skill challenges in the fourth edition. I think John Compton came up with the first draft of it, and then our design team kind of reworked it. And we've got all of these like subsystems that do the things you're looking for. I was really interested in, you're seeing kind of this evolution in D&D even now, because the latest adventure that came out last week, Beyond the Feywild adventure. It has a complete non-combat resolution option for every single encounter in that book.
Yeah, that was, I saw that.
If you do, and you're, it's funny because you were saying like, well, if you encounter a wild animal, like, what are you going to do? And I'm like, druid, like that. That's what the spell is for, right? Like, and not every player is going to like this. I think Owen's observation of the big tent is exactly what Wizards is thinking. Like, let's create an adventure where, yeah, it's got a lot of traditional high action adventure, but if you want to find a nonviolent conflict resolution way to get through this whole thing, you can. And 5e is going to support the next edition, D&D, whatever we see in 2024, is going to support that.
And a hush comes over the room. it was funny too, because like we do the sci-fi writers playing old school D&D show on Twitch, and it's funny because like there'll be entire sessions where there's no combat at all. These guys just what do you call it? They talk their way through things, and I'm just like, dude, awesome.
Yeah,
you know, and it's great to see the role play possibilities and the wheels that turn when these guys are doing it.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's just fantastic. So like to see stuff like that, you know, to convince the druid that's gonna, you know, wash out an entire kingdom with a tidal wave, you know, to convince him that this is not the way he needs to go, and you know, blah blah blah, and talk their way through that was awesome.
One of the neat things in fifth edition D&D 5 that I liked was the introduction of inspiration, which is a simple mechanic, but it is, to my knowledge, and Owen, you can correct me, the first time D&D has had any mechanical reward for good role playing.
Yeah, right? So we put that in all the time.
Yeah, if you role play your character well, you get a cookie, and you can use the cookie to re-roll a die roll. Right,
and that's a classic from things like Savage Worlds.
Yeah,
you know,
we're gonna. My hunch is that we're gonna see more like non-combat role play mechanical interactions and rewards and whatever comes next, because that's what the players are playing.
So well, it's also, I mean, there are a few of those books as well pointed out that are selling really well on DM's Guild, but it's kind of a new thing. I mean, it's only been a few years. I can't even think of there being a book that was for D&D that wasn't about, hey, here's some new character options, or here's some new gear, or here's some new monsters.
I don't know. Owen, I bet you could. There's plenty of old 3 and 3.5 things that were non-combat related.
Well, that's a good point.
Third
Ed boom, yeah.
Especially if you're talking about third-party stuff, right?
Yeah.
There was Diplomats and Demagogues, which is specifically, which was Atlas, which is specifically about talking your way through things.
Yeah.
One of the fascinating things about the Dungeon Masters Guild is that it is essentially a safe harbor to create official fan material, which is what the OGL was sort of always supposed to be, but the OGL got away from the original intent. And so the Dungeon Masters Guild has a much stronger set of limits, and you can, you know, there is in fact a 5e OGL. You can build 5e OGL stuff. I do it all the time. But they put as little in it as they possibly could. So if you want all of the toys to make it easy, and then they have the extra layer of, hey, here's some art, here's some templates, and here's the right to say this happens in the Forgotten Realms, that draw put a lot of energy into the Dungeon Masters Guild, and Wizards of the Coast gets a cut of that. And I know that people roll their eyes, oh my God, 50% is so much to give up. Those people have never had to sell a print product into distribution at a 60% discount, right? If it's a $20 book, we get eight of that, and then the distributors get a cut, and then and it's 35% on one bookshelf in general if you're not exclusive. So that means I'm playing the 35% I normally pay and 15% for a D&D license, which is it's a high license cost, but it is not out of the realm of what I've heard of before. And D&D is one of the biggest absolute things. So there are a bunch of market forces that I think Wizards of the Coast has been paying attention to. And I think the Dungeon Masters Guild and how popular some streaming shows have become, you know, they did a Critical Role book. Green Ronin did one first, but Wizards of the Coast did come along and scoop up that license and do a Critical Role book. And that means that at least some shot callers at WotC thought that was a big enough part of their market to give them one of their very rare hard books.
Did you say some shot callers?
Shot callers.
Oh, shot callers. Shock collars.
I don't know how the shock collars control their raptors, right? That's all after my time at Wizards of the Coast. Shock collars was not what we used at Paizo, but I'm not at Paizo anymore, so I don't know how they control the warehouse raptors now. There are warehouse raptors at Paizo. That's cookies.
We bribe cookies, them.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes perfect sense.
John Givens here brings up a really good point that a lot of virtual tabletops are just kind of clunky right now. And so a lot of podcasting shows just simply don't use them or they rely on more theater of the mind stuff because it's faster and easier than trying to navigate through RPG through Roll 20 or Foundry or something. And so this suggests that Owen is right, that the future version of Dungeons and Dragons might have virtual tabletop as an option, but it's not going to be too closely linked because a lot of people just that tech barrier is what's one barrier too many, right? And they don't want to deal with that.
At some point, hopefully it gets to where it's just an app on your phone and everything is intuitive and you can just click through it and be there, but we're not there yet.
That's the dream. But honestly, like I'm still kind of with Owen and still like, you know, the four kids in their basement killing wargs, you know, like on a map, like that's the deepest, most ancestral D&D itch for me. And it would be a real shame to lose that aspect. And I think Wizards knows that. They know that that's not going.
Yeah, no, I absolutely don't think they have any interest in losing the types of play they have, even if they aren't necessarily bending over backwards to give those people only the kinds of rules they want.
Yeah, no one's going to tell Dwarven Forge to stop making 3D model miniatures, right? Like that kind of stuff is just too good. Oh, and speaking of miniatures, like if you can go on to, was it Hero Forge? Is that the mini maker?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you can make any mini you want on there now. Of course, we're going to support minis because that's a huge,
right.
That's a huge part of the game. Yeah.
Well, and Wizards of the Coast sells miniatures.
Yeah.
They make money selling miniatures. Now, I think Hero Forge is what we're going to see more and more and more and more of.
Yeah.
Where yes, you can assemble it yourself. They may not all be that complex, right? There might be a simple system like, hey, here's a hero. Press a button for a longsword, press a button for great axe, button for club, button for hammer. And then either print it at home or pay us and we'll ship it to you. I think that is going to be the wave of the future, absolutely. But I think Wizards of the Coast did not get to be the size and success that it is. Yeah, if you can buy the 3D print files, right, you can do that on Hero Forge right now. You can buy the file and print as many of it as you want. You just can't resell it. And there are a lot of people that do 3D printing and have reseller options. And I think all of that is – I think we're going to start seeing STL files being common on things like Dungeon Masters Guild. So you'll be able to say, hey – I have made a miniature of a beholder wearing a cowboy hat. So if you want a beholder with a cowboy hat, here it is. Print it out yourself.
Or can you imagine an adventure where the boss at the end comes with a file so you can print off a mini for him?
I can absolutely imagine that, 100%.
Yeah, that'd be cool. You know,
we already have Paizo doing pawns for each adventure path, right? And those don't cover absolutely every monster, because you're like, well, they should have the base set. They ought to have a wolf covered. But if, in fact, they have a Lenorm with a cowboy hat because you are facing Old West dragons, and that's not weirder than some of the stuff Paizo APs have done, then sure, that would, in fact, have a Lenorm with a cowboy hat pawn in it, for sure. And people from the outside, when you're looking at Wizards of the Coast and Paizo and Green Ronin and maybe even my own tiny company, Rogue Genius Games, right? And you've got a hardback from each of us. And you might go through them and you say, okay, I see that the paper quality of Rogue Geniuses is a little lower. And maybe I recognize the names of the artists at Wizards of the Coast a little higher. But these products are all really similar. So they must be made by similar companies. That second step is where you are utterly divorcing yourself from reality. There is no RPG company anywhere near the scale of Wizards of the Coast, I think, in the world, but certainly not in North America. Paizo is nowhere near Wizards of the Coast, but it is so much higher than almost all of the next tier companies, whatever they are, that are still doing RPGs.
What about Wendy's? Maybe,
what?
What about Wendy's?
Wendy's is an RPG publisher now, yeah.
Wendy's is an RPG publisher, but I believe they have allowed that edition to go dead, right?
Yes, that's true.
And then you come down to my company, which, you know, you are looking at my company. It's my computer, my chair, and a whiteboard behind me. That's it. So when you're talking about what are they going to do as technology and computers and 3D printing advances, the opportunities for Wizards of the Coast to say, I think we should put $500,000 into developing a thing. I'm not saying that that's not a gamble for them, but it's a gamble that doesn't destroy the company.
Right.
You've got companies like Paizo who can maybe decide to do that, but they are potentially putting the entire company at risk.
And we're paying for it for a decade.
Yeah, exactly. Let's not get into any specific details, because it's a good company, man. But that idea did not come out of nowhere from me. And then we come to Rogue Genius Games, and we're like, I could be right. It could be a brilliant idea for me to invest $500,000 in something. I can't. It's not an option. And there are companies much bigger than mine for whom a $500,000 cost is not an option.
But I'll tell you, I keep interrupting.
No, go ahead.
I'll tell you, though, like, I really do think that in this sense, Wizard floats all boats. Like, it gets more people playing role-playing games, and every D&D player is a player of some other game that could potentially be lured away, right? And there's a lot of sometimes there's a lot of resentment addressed at D&D for its, like, well, you know, play something else. Okay, I don't actually ascribe to that. I really do think that Wizards creates a wake that the whole industry can follow in on. And it exposes more people to gaming. It popularizes gaming. It gets gaming into markets that are new. And it recruits new players to role playing that would not have played before. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the way World of Darkness transformed the gaming industry back in the 90s, right? Where suddenly we had a lot of women and like LGBTQ players and a lot of people coming to gaming that had never gamed before because they didn't see themselves in gaming. Like, it wasn't a hobby that where they felt welcome. And the White Wolf and the World of Darkness was like, come on in, man, the water's fine. And that really brought a new kind of energy to the game, the whole hobby.
And it also, I mean, World of Darkness focused on an entirely different genre that had not been explored in anything like that depth.
Yeah.
And it had a lot of not stabbing the orc kind of storylines. So for me, it was just a case of people had decided that role-playing games were this thing, and that thing was epitomized by D&D, and even people who made other role-playing games were basically trying to make D&D, but better, maybe in a different genre. And World of Darkness really was something very much else. And I think that was a great explosion forward.
It's many, many cape companies.
Yeah, it did. It totally did. And that is actually, I think, where the idea that Wizards of the Coast doing well rises all tides. Mm. I actually think that most D&D players, the vast majority of them, are never going to be anything but D&D players.
Oh, really?
Now, it does happen that the tiny fraction of them that we can peel off, that's enough to buy me a mansion, right? That kind of fraction, if I can get them all, I can live very comfortably, especially if I stay in Oklahoma. But where the industry as a whole does benefit, and I'm literally going to spin my camera around, this is a Lazy Susan battle mat on a slide that can slide back and forth across the table.
Sweet.
So that bit of kit is clearly exists because D&D players and board gamers in that case find it useful. That's not what we use it for, but it's there so that we can buy it and then we have more fun with our game. Same with it's miniatures.
Like it's like an infrastructure. Wizards helps create the infrastructure that the rest of us can then use.
Dwarven Forge is not D&D exclusive, but without D&D, Dwarven Forge would not have existed. One of my friends is very much into Dwarven Forge, and he happens to use them for Pathfinder First Edition games. And so we'll have very complicated builds of towers and caverns and chasms and rivers, and that is a different gaming experience. And it is that experience appeals to some people for whom Theater of the Mind doesn't. And Theater of the Mind appeals for some people for whom gritty miniature stuff doesn't. And all of those different infrastructure things, all of those physical materials being out there, Hero Lab and Dwarven Forge and the 3D table here and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
If you are trying to play any genre that is well-known and well-supported, you've got all these things to pick from without the parent company having to put them out.
Well, hey, we've been talking for almost an hour now. I think we've covered things pretty thoroughly. Any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
Someday allow me to tell you guys my only brush with World of Darkness. It was weird. Not something for broadcast, though.
It is hard for me to imagine you playing Vampire Wolf.
it got weird there for a minute, mostly for them.
I mean, when I played Vampire, I played a Toreador that could store blood, so I would suck the blood of drunks, store it, and sell it to people as Bloodweiser so that vampires could get a buy.
That's awesome. Oh, God.
That was my political empire. Booze.
I gotta tell you, I thought Werewolf was the best game of Old World of Darkness, but mainly because it had that fuzzy superheroes kind of, basically, kind of like Batman with a five o'clock shadow all the time.
Save the world from the evil corporations. Yeah.
I find it fascinating that you went to Batman instead of saying you're playing Wolverine, right? You're furious, you have rage issues, you claw things apart, and you heal. Basically, Werewolf is everyone gets to be Wolverine.
Well, but the difference in that is it's much more apropos for the Batman analogy because Batman, one is his mask and one is his true self, but which one is which? Wolverine, he's just Wolverine all the time. The mask was just there because it was a fashion choice.
Right. Wolverine put on an eye patch and he was a different character.
And he was patched. Madripoor. Yeah.
Well, in Amalgam, to put on my comic geek cap, they actually merged those two characters.
What was it? Backlaw? Darkclaw.
Night Stabber, I forget exactly what it
was. Night Stabber.
Shadow Knife. Wow, we're running a 90s comic universe right now, just off the top of our heads. That's great.
You could do it.
The Amalgam universe will never die.
What was it, 90s comics? As long as everything had pouches and somebody had the name Blood, with the name Blood, you were good?
Yeah, indeed. All right, so new D&D stuff is happening, and you've been listening to Walt, Owen, and Jason's take on it. Any closing thoughts, guys, before we play that beautiful audiovisual outro music?
Roll that beautiful bean footage.
Just this. New editions coming. New books, same editions coming. Don't worry about it. Don't freak out. No one is breaking into your home and stealing the books you currently have and love. And with the Dungeon Masters Guild and third-party publishers, there will always be new adventures and new support. Play what you like. Pick it up if you want. Don't if you don't. There is free RPG material on the web, and if you are listening to us, you have the kind of infrastructure to get at it. Just have a good time and play whatever you want to play.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, as a publisher, I'm kind of worried because I'm aspiring to be where guys like you are. I mean, I'm hoping to save up for a whiteboard one day, Owen.
Well, this isn't even my whiteboard, right? This room is rented, so I can't afford to buy a whiteboard. It's a timeshare.
Fair enough. And on that happy note.
What would be really cool if you could time the outro with when you press the button?
Oh, so there's not that awkward half second?
Yeah, that would be dope. Nice. But you know, the awkward half second is kind of our thing.
Awkwardness is kind of our brand. We lean into it hard. So that's all right. Thanks, folks. We'll catch you next time on the BAMF podcast.
Ciao. Bye.